You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Takawingawa. Mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. E wha ake nei, coming up on the show, for City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about the consultation process for local board plans and the New Zealand First campaign on scrapping the independent Māori statutory board for Auckland. For politics with Marnie Dunlop, we caught up about the Conservation Amendment Bill, the Nelson 10th Trust Bill introduction and recent polling. And I spoke to Dr. Antje Deckert, Associate Professor in Criminology at Auckland University of Technology, about the impact tougher penalties for theft would have on women and children. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, News Director Castor spoke with Shannon Halbert about the government's environmental policy and the Green Party's tax announcement. Producer Pranusha spoke to Professor Andrew Schelling about a new breast cancer treatment that poses an alternative to chemotherapy. He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka wea wari wari iahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he pakehiri rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tuku tuku o ererangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM erekati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text your thoughts in on Lima Toru Iwa Lima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The Conservation Amendment Bill is set to allow the government to sell large sections of conservation land. The bill has been criticised not just for the sales that the government has confirmed, but also for its potential to open further sales of large swathes of native bush. The policy joins others by the government, such as a reduction in environmental reporting and the Fast Track Approvals Bill, which each continue to threaten the environment for short-term financial gain. In addition, while each of these policies are unpopular with the public, the government appears not to care. Also, this past weekend saw the Green Party announce its tax policy for the upcoming election, with a range of new taxes and a cut to income tax for the first $10,000 of earnings. For this week's catch-up with the Labour Party, Shannon Halbert, News Director Castor asked about the government's environmental policies and the Greens' tax policy, beginning with the latter.
To start us off, we saw the Green Party announce some of their tax policy over the weekend, and the Labour Party ruled this out pretty early on, with Chris Hipkins saying that the party disagreed with the majority of the proposal. What is the Labour Party's view on these tax proposals, and why is there that disagreement there?
Well, Labour's focused on jobs, health, homes and re-election on the cost of living. We've laid out our tax plan with a targeted capital gains tax, and we've said what we'll do, what we'll use that money for, which is a health plan for every New Zealander, three free GP visits using your Medicard. We think it's important that we are very clear with New Zealanders around our intentions with the capital gains tax and where it will be spent. And so that's what we're focused on in this election period.
And moving on now to the Conservation Amendment Bill, the government says the bill is about modernising conservation law, cutting red tape and making better use of conservation land. What's Labour's response to that framing?
Well, it really shows how out of touch both Prime Minister Christopher Luxon and Minister Tama Pōtaka actually are. When you think that two-thirds of New Zealanders oppose selling off conservation land because they know that once conservation land is sold, it's gone for good.
And the government claims that a lot of the conservation land that would be sold is not land that wildlife is on, you know, it's farms or other parts of the country. Is that something that the Labour Party agrees with or is interested in selling or doing something with going forward?
Well, National's treating it almost like it's a clearance sale. Tama Pōtaka's job as minister is to protect these places for future generations. and instead he's paving the way for future sale.
Yeah, critics, as you said there, critics say the issue is not just what land could be sold now, but the precedent that it sets for future governments. Does Labor share that concern, and could further protections be put in place under a Labor government to ensure our public land doesn't see such sales going forward?
Well, Nationals refuse to rule out selling some of our most high-value conservation land, and I think of places like Aotea Conservation Park, Cathedral Close, Cove, you know, and then I think about the reaction from iwi, that they are offended by this. That's had to go to court to be able to sort this out. And I think in principle, at the very least, should there be a sale, that these would be available for iwi in the first place, and that they shouldn't have to pay for it using it as a part of a Waitangi claim.
And if the government were to sell large parts of conservation land or these locations that you've just mentioned, would a future Labor government commit to buying these back and putting them back under public ownership?
Well, we don't have those details as yet, and it is before the court. But the reality is that Labor will be doing everything it possibly can to stop this bill from proceeding dead in its tracks before this election. We'll be focused on winning the election so that this we can put this particular bill to bed for a very, very long time.
Alongside the Conservation Amendment Bill, the government is also changing environmental reporting rules. Does Labor see this as a sensible streamlining or a weakening of environmental oversight?
Yeah, I don't think we've taken a full position on this one as yet, but what I do know is that some work was done on this in the last Labor government. We know that some data and reporting gaps, and this bill says it will help guide where those gaps are and help address them. When it comes to the National-led government meddling with data and reporting, I do worry because they have changed the goalposts in other areas, and so I would be keeping a very, very close eye on this one.
Do you think that New Zealanders are currently being given sufficient information to understand the state of the environment and also the other laws that the government is passing at the moment?
Well, I think it's important that data acquisition continues to evolve. I think we learn so much from it, and so it can always be better. But this bill will reduce the frequency of the state of the environment report. And this should also be read through the lens of a government, again, that has deprioritised our climate and our environment through various pieces of legislation. So, I would be following them with a very, very watchful eye on this one.
And on those sort of mining and fast-track approvals as well, Reuters reported this week that New Zealand is fast-tracking gold projects and courting mining investors, with gold production on track to double by the mid-2030s. The government is pushing mining and fast-track approvals as part of its economic growth agenda. Does Labor think economic growth is being prioritised over some of our environmental protections?
Well, we've been against National's fast-track policy since it came to the House. We think it erodes the environmental rights in New Zealand and also doesn't recognise and in fact breaches Te Tiriti of Waitangi in many respects. So there are opportunities for our economy and critical minerals, but they shouldn't be mined at the expense of our environment, especially our conservation estate.
The coalition parties have been arguing that mining brings regional jobs and improves export revenue. How does Labor balance those economic benefits against environmental risks?
Well, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. And this is where the National-led government and Christopher Luxon continue to fail our environment and treaty rights. It's important that they, while they can create jobs through large-scale projects, and Labor did this, through their own fast-track process during the COVID period. But what we didn't do was erode the recognition of our environment. Our job is to protect that for future generations and ensure that we're meeting our obligations under Te Tiriti o Waitangi.
And the Labor Party has previously spoken about making changes to the fast-track bill. What would those changes look like?
We're yet to lay out our full policy, which will be coming in the coming months. But you will remember that under a Labor government, we were doing work on critical minerals that would help us decarbonise and move away from fossil fuels like coal in a way that ensures there are jobs long term. So you can expect from Labor that we will continue to uphold the rights of Te Tiriti and protect our environment at the same time, while creating jobs for New Zealanders.
And balancing things on the other side, the government has noted that New Zealand has some infrastructure problems that are in need of solutions through energy development or water infrastructure development. Is that something that the government is, or that the Labour Party is concerned about? And are there pathways in place to ensure that we can develop this infrastructure in a way that is healthy and sustainable?
Well, we are concerned about National's leadership and lack of protection for our environment. Labor had a fast-track process included in the Natural and Built Environment Act that worked incredibly well, and almost 100 projects were approved without undue delay or excessive cost because of it. And so, you know, these things can be done. You can create jobs through new projects, but you can protect the environment at the same time.
That was Labour MP Shannon Halbert speaking about the Green Party's tax announcement and the government's range of environmental policies.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland's local boards have opened consultation on their three-year plans. Feedback received during this process will inform final plans that will be adopted later this year. And New Zealand First has announced a campaign for the independent Māori statutory board to be scrapped due to its influence on council decision making. However, Mayor Wayne Brown called this campaign dumb racist stuff. For City Councilling this week, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about both of these topics. I started by asking if she could explain what is covered in the local board plans that are currently out for consultation.
So local boards are the 21 sort of like local decision makers across the Auckland region who focus on a local area. So my job as a councillor is to look regionally, but I used to be on a local board for 12 years. I was on the Puketapapa one in Mount Boscombe, and the local board's job is to go, okay, what are our community's aspirations for our local area, how it fits regionally, but what do people want to see and experience, and what do they want their lives to be like in our community locally? And so the local board plan is the document that reflects that lists what the community's aspirations are for their own area. They might look more broadly too, but they might be things like, you know, we'd all like to be able to move around our community safely, be able to access local jobs and education without having to go too far away from where we live. It might have stuff around local climate initiatives and stuff like that. So the local board plan gets written every 3 years through consultation with the community, and that consultation on the draft is open right now. And once it's finalised later in the year, that then becomes the document that whenever the local board is making decisions on how to spend their money, how to prioritise community grants, which events they should or shouldn't do, that kind of stuff, they will always look back to the local board plan and go, how does this align with our plan, with our basically our sort of contract with our community about how we're shaping and forming our local area for the future. So that's the purpose of the local board plan. And community input is absolutely key to getting those plans right, because otherwise you end up with a plan that doesn't reflect what local people really want and see as the future for their area. And then the local board's decisions won't line up, and it all sort of starts to get very messy and doesn't work very well. So having a say in those local board plan processes is important, particularly if there's something you care about that local government touches on.
And on that point, would you encourage people who haven't submitted on it before to submit for the first time, and for people who maybe don't usually engage with council processes as much, like young people who might be listening to this interview, do you encourage them to submit on their local board plan as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a few different ways to do it. And when we talk about submissions, often the types of submissions you can actually do them in a range of different ways. It doesn't have to be to go online and sort of fill out quite a stodgy form, although you can do that if you want to, or you can even do a paper form. You can get one at your local library. But actually, you can just write a paragraph or two. You don't have to answer every question and all that kind of stuff. But there's also, this time around, there's been a lot of work done with Buzzly, which I understand is quite appealing to young people. And I've actually just been having a little look on it, and there's a specific challenge on Buzzly: did your local board get it right for young people? And that's another way that you can make a submission without sort of formally making a submission. And I've just been looking through some of the ideas that have been shared there. People writing down, sort of two or three paragraphs about what they really care about. So there was one there that was about, fast fashion, wanting to see less fast fashion and a more sustainable approach to that kind of stuff. There was something else about being able to move around the community safely. So those kinds of things, Buzzly is a really good option that looks pretty appealing. And I know that I am no longer in the demographic and haven't been for a long time, but I understand that's a pretty popular platform for that kind of thing. There's also going to be face-to-face opportunities too, where you can come and talk directly to your local board members. There'll likely be, because we normally do this, there'll likely be things where, like, for example, you can put a sticker on the stuff that is your priority so that they can know, okay, well, this is supported more than this in terms of when they're doing their final ones. I know that the Waitemata Local Board in particular, which covers the areas that the University of Auckland and AUT are both in, the city centre, and young people tend to spend a lot of time in the city centre, they have a lot of drop-in sessions for people to have chats with them. So that's worth going along and having a conversation, having a kōrero as well, as a good way to give feedback.
And I want to switch gears now to ask about the Independent Māori Statutory Board. What is your response to New Zealand First's campaign on scrapping this board?
So we have had the Independent Māori Statutory Board, which is also known as Haukura. That's the official name they adopted, I feel like it was about 3 years ago. That was created by law when Auckland Council was established, because Auckland Council did not, and at that time could not, have any Māori wards. And so the purpose of it isn't really, though, to be Māori representation as such, because the members of the Independent Māori Statutory Board are appointed through a process with iwi and with mataawaka organisations, who are the groups that represent Māori who don't whakapapa to Auckland's whenua. So they're Māori with who are mana whenua in other parts of Aotearoa, not Auckland's whenua. So it's quite well evolved and established. The inputs that those Haukura members give onto our committees I have found incredibly valuable. They effectively operate for Auckland not so much as Māori representation, because they are not elected by Māori and they're very aware of that, but more as like a treaty, an ongoing sort of treaty audit for us. Like, so they will constantly be bringing up, how does this align with the Council's treaty obligations? They actually literally do reports that are issues of significance for Māori and encourage Council to adopt things, that kind of stuff. And actually they've supported and then had democratic support from councillors over a long period of time, a whole lot of amazing initiatives for acknowledging that Tāmaka Makaurau is a city, land given by Māori in the cases of a lot of the city centre. But we are unique in the world, right? And how do we reflect our uniqueness? A lot of that is about centering te ao Māori and making that visible in our daily lives and meaningful. We also have the situation where a lot of the communities of greatest need include Māori. you know, our homeless are unfortunately a very high proportion of them are Māori. And, you know, that is at least in part a result of, you know, colonisation, discrimination, racism over decades. So for me, having Haukura, the Independent Māori Statutory Board, there is vital. Currently, we are not able to give them voting rights on the actual governing body of council. We had a vote a couple of years ago about whether or not to add Māori wards. That was a very tight vote that unfortunately was lost. And so while this brings a Māori voice to the table, it is a different scenario from having elected Māori representation. So, I mean, my preference would be that we had Māori wards and that we still maintained a role for Haukura that acknowledged that their role is actually a bit different from elected Māori representation, and they are more in that sort of treaty audit space. And bring, you know, so that they're entitled to be, under the Resource Management Act, they're actually entitled to be on a bunch of committees separate from the Local Government Act stuff. Yeah, and the Mayor has been very supportive of Haukura, and yeah, has responded very strongly to New Zealand First on that. And I don't always agree with the Mayor, but I agree with the Mayor on this one.
I really appreciate the positive elements of the statutory board. It sounds like they bring something really positive to the community. And as you say, the Mayor has been outspoken in his support of the board. Are councillors and community members that you're hearing from also generally supportive?
I think a lot of people don't know about Haukura. They don't necessarily understand their role. You know, but to be honest, there's a lot of parts of council where that's the case. A lot of work that our staff do, a lot of decisions that we make as elected members. A lot of people, you know, we just talked about local board plans. A lot of people still have no idea what a local board even is after, you know, 16 years of having none, and that being the most local representation of local government in every community in Auckland. So I think the fact that people don't know about something shouldn't necessarily mean it has no value. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, people don't know about that have extraordinary value. And, you know, I think, for example, of our stormwater systems, which 4 years ago very few people knew about, and in 2023 we all had to learn about that in real time, you know, the value of a stormwater system. So putting that to one side, I think councillors experience usually at least once or twice a week the value that the Haukura members bring to our committees and our discussions, and I would hope that they would be supportive of that continuing. Yeah, but I think more broadly there's not necessarily a wide understanding. And that is a risk. When people don't understand something, they tend to think it's not necessary. But as I said, 4 years ago, a lot of people didn't know about stormwater, and turns out it's super necessary.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on the consultation process for local board plans and the New Zealand First campaign on scrapping the Independent Māori Statutory Board.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts 5395.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling the bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95BFM.
A glittering world awaits you at the Auckland Live Cabaret Festival. And 95BFM have double passes for a variety of the spectacular shows to give away to B-card holders. Just stay tuned to Drive all week for your cue to enter. Don't miss the Auckland Live Cabaret Festival. On now at the Civic till Sunday, July 5th. Your ticket to the extraordinary AucklandLive.co.nz.
Give a shit, give a little.
95 BFM. Give a little.
Give a little.
It's funny that you said give it a little like three times in that statement.
Donate to 95BFM a little today.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
The debate over the Conservation Amendment Bill has intensified in recent weeks, particularly after it was criticised by iwi and environmental advocates. The government has introduced the Te Here Anuku Nelson 10th Bill to Parliament, which will enable the return of 3,000 hectares of land to its customary owners at the top of the South Island. And both Labour and National are down in the latest One News Variant poll, with smaller parties rising. For politics with Marnie Dunlop of Te Ao Māori News, I have Marnie on the line to discuss these topics. Kia ora, Marnie. Firstly, it would be great if you could start by explaining the Conservation Amendment Bill and how it will change how conservation land is managed.
Kia ora, o te rā, tēnā tātou katoa. Yeah, so the Conservation Amendment Bill has, or the debate around it has, like you said, intensified, but it's been getting a bit fiery, to be honest, in the last kind of few days, especially with the Minister for Conservation, Tama Pōtaka, being quite defensive in his bill and arguing in support of his bill. So, you know, the government says their argument is the bill modernises conservation laws and will make it easier to deliver infrastructure, tourism and renewable energy projects on conservation land, and that the pockets in which will be part of that 60%, that could be what they call, is the language or jargon they use, as being disposed of, you know, like buildings that are sitting near unused, or little kind of landlocked little pieces of gravel, pockets of land that could be sold to the private owner. So that's their argument. But, you know, on the other side, and we've been seeing Forest and Bird come out quite strongly, Greenpeace with their interactive map around what particular parts of land this would look like, and obviously iwi, and opposition parties, Green Party and Labour, being quite strong against it, and Te Pāti Māori. Their argument says that it opens the door to greater commercial use of those particular parcels of land, and also the concerns around mining. Because just for more context, you know, if you want to, if people want to mine on whenua and conservation whenua, they have to go through the conservation minister. So there's that layer there to kind of test it, because we currently have mining on conservation land under this government. But if those particular lands are disposed of, then there's no longer that blanket or that safeguard there. So today, though, a kind of new development in the conservation amendment space, the Greens have announced they would legislate to ban the sale of conservation land and strengthen protections if they were to be voted into government. And they, you know, continue the argument that government is viewing conservation land as an economic asset rather than a taonga. Again, like I said, Pōtaka has been coming out, Minister Pōtaka has been coming out quite strong, and calling it scandalous and mischievous for people to suggest that he's selling off big, large parcels of land. So, you know, there's also... But there's been massive public backlash. 50,000 people have signed a petition opposing this particular part of the amendment bill. And so, you know, it's becoming a bit wider around conservation. And I guess for the iwi lens as well, there are some potential iwi that, you know, could benefit around wanting to buy some of their land back. But also there are a lot of iwi who are worried around, you know, whether or not they would have first right of refusal to particular pockets of land, and what the safeguards there around mana whenua engagement. So in a complicated nutshell, Caden, that's kind of where we're at with the conservation amendment bill this week.
I'm really interested in that point about why iwi are concerned about it. Could this also have an impact on future treaty claims, for example?
Yeah, for sure, because, you know, obviously with a lot of settlements that have already passed, conservation land is a huge part of those particular settlements. You know, look at Tūhoe, and, you know, the conservation estate there is in Ngāi Tahu. And so, you know, with potential settlements being being negotiated at the moment, you know, what is the safeguard within those particular negotiations of what the Amendment Act and the impact it could have on them? I put that question to Minister Paul Sakara. I said, you know, these are the concerns that we have raised, and what are the assurances can you give around what those safeguards look like? And he argues that those safeguards are there and that it's not going to have an impact, and he claims that it's going to actually be more beneficial, but that's not necessarily concrete within the legislation. So again, around what that looks like, and they're open for submissions, and the submissions close on the 2nd of July, so this will go to Select Committee, so no doubt we'll see a lot of the narrative from and a lot of the views of iwi and members of the public around, you know, their views on this particular bill.
And I want to turn now to ask about the Nelson Tents Bill. Could you explain the Te Here Anuku Nelson Tents Bill, including, and I know there's over 100 years of history here, but could you summarise the land dispute that has led to the bill?
Yeah, so this is such a fascinating bill and litigation. And, you know, for this to be done under a national government is also really interesting. But just to kind of summarise the bill, you know, it settles one of Aotearoa's longest-running land disputes, which dates back to the 1840s. And it recognises generations of land loss after the Crown failed to protect that land that had been promised to Māori as part of the Nelson settlement. You know, so they were promised a tenth of that, a 10% of that particular land. That's why it's called the Nelson Tents Trust. And so this is a landmark piece of legislation that was actually done under Judith Collins as the Attorney General. And again, the distinction around it not being a treaty settlement is really key, because it's around land litigation and viewed as a private issue because there was a Supreme Court ruling that voted in favour of the Tents Trust or Te Here Anuku. And as part of this package, a compensation or resolution, as they're labelling it, they're getting 3,000 hectares of their whenua are being returned and $420 million in financial compensation for the land that they can't return. What's really interesting is part of that, the land that has been returned is quite popular conservation land, separate to the Amendment Act. Don't get confused with that. It's conservation land with the Able Tasman Park, Kai Tiri Tiri, Tōtara Nui. So for those, I know we're in the Auckland audience, but for those who have been down to the top of the South Island, they're pretty beautiful pieces of whenua. And so that's actually going to be going back into the hands of the Tents Trust. Now, as part of this deal and the litigation around that, in 25 years, the Tents Trust and the mana whenua will relook at or renegotiate what that access looks like and whose hands it'll stay in, because currently it'll stay in dock for the next 25 years, but that could potentially change. But the Trust has been very adamant that public access will not change. I just spoke to the chair or one of the trustees of the Trust who said, you know, in the Rohe and Whakatū, there's been massive, positive response to this particular litigation, and they've got really good relationships there to look forward around the prosperity. So the significant milestone for this particular legislation, it's going to have its first reading in Parliament today, and then it has to become, obviously, a bill, but it has to become law. So after its third reading, then it'll be very clear around, you know, that $420 million, that 3,000 hectares, what that looks like for the future of the Rohe.
You mentioned it was interesting that this was coming under a national government, and I know Willie Jackson talked about how Labor had made attempts to negotiate on this, but why has it taken so long? What have been the barriers for previous governments, and why is it happening now?
So I asked Karenza, the trustee of the Tents Trust today about that particular point. And, you know, Labor, there were attempts by Labor to negotiate that, and that didn't happen for a number of reasons. And, you know, Willie has said, because it's a significant decision for a government to make, because $420 million, I mean, if you look at the broader kind of value of treaty settlements, although this isn't a settlement, but, you know, kind of in that context, if we were to look at it, it's almost a quarter of all settlements that have been made to date by the Crown, and that's looking at about 80 to 100 settlements. So this is a significant amount of money and land to be given back to Māori. And, you know, one of the comments made by the opposition has said, you know, isn't it interesting and ironic that what they call an anti-Māori government, in their words, has is doing one of the most kind of significant settlements to return to Māori. But talking to Judith Collins at the time of the signing of the first announcement at the end of last year, and speaking to obviously Chris Bishop, who's now the Attorney General, for them in a national, kind of from a National Party viewpoint, it's a land litigation and it's about private land and private ownership, and it's not about whether or not they're Māori. It's just it's a principled decision. And so that's how, and also from that view, that's what Tents Trust, I'm sure, would have taken advantage of to say, well, based on your politics, you know, this is something that you should be getting across the line. And so it has meant that those negotiations were essentially expedited. But also you have to remember the Supreme Court decision last year, which was very, very strong, last year, about really strong in supporting their argument, the Tents Trust argument.
And you said today is the first reading, but how long will this process take to become law?
Yeah, I mean, how long's a piece of string? Because there's a lot of things on the order paper, but they are planning on kind of heralding this through pretty fast. And, with there's many things on the order paper on the legislative agenda of this government, and obviously the election is coming up in November, and so they're going to have to get a lot of things through before September when the House rises. So they're hoping to get this through by September, hopefully.
Speaking of the upcoming election, in the recent One News Variant poll, both major parties were down while minor parties were up. Could you talk through these results quickly?
Yeah, for sure. So a really interesting poll, and, you know, based on TVNZ's previous polls, one of the lowest, that was the lowest in, I think, 30 years for their main parties. And so, and the Greens, saw Te Pāti Māori remained stable. ACT went down a little bit, and which has been kind of a trend in the last few polls that we've seen. But most interesting was the Opportunities Party, which is a party that has never got into government. They've always kind of been trying to get in there, but they were at about a 4.6% margin. So that's been quite an interesting part of that poll, and what a lot of the questions of the parties have been asked in Parliament this week of, you know, which side and who would work with the Opportunities Party, and whether they would or whether they wouldn't. But, you know, it's very good for the Opportunities Party in terms of edging towards that, and good amount of press for them. But also, I guess, a really interesting aspect of the numbers of that poll, I think it was about 14% of people didn't know who they were going to vote for. And that's really significant. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who are undecided, which would obviously, you'd assume that margin would be the people who would vote for the major parties, and they're unsure at the moment of what that looks like. And also just goes back to our MMP structure within Aotearoa, and that these minor parties can be, you know, play a really big part in, you know, Te Pāti Māori potentially being a kingmaker if they can win their Māori electorates back. You know, that's a whole other kōrero, which I'm sure we'll talk about another day, Ewa. But, and also, obviously, Opportunities Party, if they keep on edging up, then they could be also in the same waka around being that kingmaker potentially.
I have so many more questions, and as you say, this could be a completely different kōrero, but I do want to finish by asking, based on the conversations that you're having at the moment in communities and in your role as a journalist, do you have any understanding of why the voters you're talking to are turning to minor parties?
I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of analysis that could be done within that question, but I think, you know, there's a little bit of a disengagement or disheartenment with the leadership of both parties. And, you know, we've seen Labor come out with a few announcements, a few policy announcements, and you know, pretty much firing back at Labor and National firing back at each other is consistently what I see. Some of, you know, most of the press releases that are coming back is there, you know, with around them just kind of paying each other out. And so I think, based on my conversations, I think a lot of members of the public are kind of sick of that. People are struggling to put food on the table. People are struggling to pay the bills. I mean, they're not too worried about the shots being fired at other political parties. You know, they want to know what's going to serve them and what's going to benefit our whānau at the end of the day. And so that's what people are looking for. And they're finding that in those policies from those minor parties are the conversations I'm having. So in a nutshell, I'd say, you know, that's probably the crux of why we're seeing this particular trend.
Kia ora. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Ho. I really appreciate it. That was Marnie Dunlop on the Conservation Amendment Bill, the Nelson Tents Trust Bill introduction and first reading today, and the recent One News Variant poll.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
A breast cancer expert is calling for drug abemaciclib to be publicly funded through PharmAc, saying it could improve long-term survival for some patients with early-stage breast cancer. Abemaciclib is a targeted cancer medicine that can be added to endocrine therapy to reduce the risk of cancer returning and help prevent progression to incurable metastatic disease. PharmAc's application tracker currently lists abemaciclib for early-stage breast cancer as seeking clinical advice. The medication is also known by the product name Verzenio. Producer Pranuja spoke with Professor Andrew Schelling about abemaciclib and what access to newer breast cancer treatments could mean for patients in Aotearoa. Pranuja began by asking what the medication was and how it's used in treatment.
Okay, it's an exciting new type of drug. It's not a chemotherapy. It's actually a targeted cancer drug, and it specifically attacks a certain types of protein in the cell that makes the cells grow out of control and divide quickly, which is, of course, a hallmark of cancer. So it's a targeted therapy, and it's had great outcomes of late, and gives another tool in our arsenal against this deadly disease of breast cancer.
Now, you've said that Zeniol offers hope for some breast cancer patients. What kind of patients are most likely to benefit from it?
Okay. What we've done over the last few years is rather than just having just breast cancer, we've actually been able to divide it up into smaller and smaller groups. The most common subtype or group of cancer is called hormone-positive, receptor-positive breast cancer, which is the majority. And this drug specifically targets those with that common type of breast cancer, but it just adds another arm to our arsenal of drugs against hormone receptor-positive breast cancer.
And why is it so important to treat breast cancers in early stages with these kind of drugs aggressively before they start to progress?
Okay, well, we know that the sooner that you treat breast cancer or any type of cancer, the better the outcomes. We do have some other drugs that, especially for this type of breast cancer, but this one has just showed a study that's only been published this year that it showed great benefits for early stage breast cancer that could have a big benefit for women with breast cancer.
And how does it play in when a cancer becomes metastatic and preventing that progression?
Okay, so by getting cancer early, that prevents it from getting bigger and beginning to grow and spread around the body, which is metastatic breast cancer. So this drug is effective at early stages and will prevent cancer ever getting out of control and starting to spread around the body, which is usually what causes death in patients with breast cancer, when it spreads around the body and interferes with other parts and organs of the body.
And you mentioned earlier about how it's an alternative to chemotherapy. How do the symptoms play out between them? Is there one that's better for the patients?
So chemotherapy in general is very, very unpleasant, damaging, toxic and nasty. But in some cases, it's all that we can do because it just targets any dividing cell in the body, not just the cancer cells, but all other parts of the body where cells are dividing. This is an example of an increasingly large number of drugs that are called targeted therapies. So it just attacks some specific proteins in the body, and so therefore the side effect profile is much better. There are side effects, things like diarrhea and fatigue and nausea and low blood counts, which are important, but are much less severe than what we see in chemotherapy in general. So the patients have a much better quality of life while being treated with breast cancer.
Now, you've said Zeniol should be publicly funded through PharmAc. Why do you think this drug needs to be on that PharmAc list?
Well, we we need this drug for early stage breast cancer. We don't have something similar in this class of drugs. There are some other drugs that are on the list in this class, but they're for metastatic cancer. So, the recent study that's just come out shows us that currently, based on evidence, this is the best drug for attacking early stage breast cancer.
And you mentioned in your media release that Xeniol can reduce the risk of reoccurrence when added to endocrine therapy. How does that sort of work?
Okay, so women with this type of breast cancer, hormone positive, will be given endocrine therapy, which is great. This just adds more weight to improving outcomes. So this combination of treatments is currently the best that we have for women with hormone positive breast cancer. So it's just adding another part of our arsenal and making outcomes much better for women that are diagnosed with breast cancer.
When we talk about improving long-term survival, what kind of impacts are we talking about for the patients and their families when it comes to taking Xeniol as opposed to taking chemotherapy or those kinds of approaches?
Okay, I think the studies are showing about a 20% improvement above just taking endocrine therapies alone. So it's a significant improvement in outcomes for patients. So it just means that more women will be alive further down the track than with the current treatments, which is why it's important that it appears on through PharmAC and to be provided for women that are diagnosed with breast cancer.
And how do you think this plays in with early cancer diagnosis and the sort of risk factors that we have there of trying to find cancer early on?
Okay, so enormous amount of research going on here in University of Auckland and around the world to try and prevent cancer from developing in the first place. We're also working really hard at early detection of breast cancer and trying to ensure that the outcomes for early stage breast cancer are so much better. So having drugs that will back that up ensures that even if you are diagnosed with breast cancer, if it's early, then it's a treatment that may be of benefit for you. So it's just part of the package of things that we can provide, prevention, early detection, and better targeted therapies that's going to improve outcomes for women with breast cancer.
That was Professor Andrew Schelling speaking about a new breast cancer treatment drug that poses an alternative to chemotherapy.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B. This is Not Today from Jess B.
I gave you my best, you let my heart break in the worst way. Talked about the future, now I'm drinking on a Thursday. Why did you approach me? Why you want me in the first place? Yeah, I guess that I'ma be okay. Yeah, I should've known you weren't ever gonna stay. Yeah, you flying paper planes, cause you've been in my head. Yeah, I'm getting faded till the story fade away. You're the only thing I know. My love, I don't wanna be alone. Can you love me like me, baby? I need to know. I know that I'ma be okay. Yeah, yeah. I'll wait forever and a day. Yeah, yeah. I'ma be okay. Yeah, and by the way, I'ma be okay. Yeah, but not today. I'ma be okay. Yeah, but not today. I gave you my best, you let my heart break in the worst way. Talked about the future, now I'm drinking on a Thursday. Why did you approach me? Why you want me in the first place? Okay, you kiss me, baby, then let me down. A hand to hand, you led me on a dead end path. So now I walk my way back on my mind.
Thank you.
should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
New projections from the Ministry of Justice predict a significant gender shift in New Zealand's prison population over the next 10 years. This is partly due to the government's Crimes Amendment Bill that will introduce a new category of low-value theft committed in an offensive, threatening, insulting, or disorderly manner when the threshold for robbery is not met. However, increasing imprisonment rates for minor offences can lead to unnecessary violence and trauma for children separated from an incarcerated parent. I spoke to Dr. Antia Deckett, a specialist in criminology at the Auckland University of Technology School of Social Sciences, about this issue. I started by asking if she could explain the projected gender shift in the prison population and how this connects to the new law increasing penalties for theft.
So these predictions come from the Ministry of Justice themselves. There's a range of new laws that will contribute to that gender shift, and one of them is a proposed new theft law.
Can you talk more about why that link is? Is this because women are more likely to commit certain kinds of crimes?
So yeah, so we can see from the remand prison population and from also from the offences that women get charged with and that men get charged with, that women are more likely to be remanded in prison for theft offences, whereas men's top four offences are assault, burglary, offences against justice procedures, which is essentially breaking protection orders for most of them, and drug offences.
And you mentioned in your article in The Conversation that the new laws for theft are about theft that doesn't meet the threshold for robbery. Could you explain this and how it will impact women?
So we have at the moment two laws. We have theft and robbery, and the new law is trying to introduce a new law that blurs that line. So by saying we have now a new law that's called aggravated theft, which counts as stealing in an offensive, threatening, insulting, or disorderly manner, which is still a non-violent, but then introducing penalties that are closer to what we currently have for violent offences. So in my opinion, we either have theft, we either have a non-violent offence or we have a violent offence or robbery, which is for the judge to decide.
I then want to switch now to asking about the impacts of a potential increase in the number of women being imprisoned. Can you speak through the impact on communities, including subsequent generations?
So yeah, that is my biggest concern, and it was my motivation to write the article. Because from my own previous research, I know that when we lock up people, that is increasing the childhood sexual abuse risk for their children, and particularly for girls. So when you are incarcerating a father and remove them from the family environment, you're increasing the sexual assault risk for the girls, for their daughters, from 1 in 4, which is the average for all of us women, to 1 in 3. And that is because, you know, other adults get introduced in the supervision process and start exposing girls to more threat. And the concern is that when you remove the mother from the home, that risk increases then to 1 in 2. So this is a flip of a coin. There's a 50% chance of girls getting, sexually assaulted because their mother's in prison. So these are girls that have done nothing wrong. And mothers have, you know, committed non-violent offence, but then are incarcerated. And possibly, you know, they have committed that offence because of the crisis of living costs. It was very interesting. I received an email, an unsolicited email from someone commenting on the article and said, I've seen them rushing out of supermarkets with full trolleys. And I've noticed there that, you know, these are people who are stealing food. They are not stealing luxury items. They don't go and, you know, steal iPhones or what have you. They are trying to make ends meet. And sometimes we need to understand, and when people do these things and what politicians might interpret as insulting, threatening, or disorderly might actually be a form of political protest.
That's an interesting point, and I want to go into it further because my next question was going to be what can be done to mitigate this harm. Is it simply a case of repealing the Crimes Amendment Bill that increases the penalty for theft, or are there underlying issues that need to be addressed as well?
I think it is mainly looking at the underlying issues. Why are people resorting to these means? Who are the people who are acting in this way? And why are they acting in this way? And the crisis of living costs is not new to us. That's not new. And now we're coming to a new election cycle, and we are seeing, again, this tough on crime agenda, introducing new laws, when we've actually still seen a decline in the overall criminal proceedings. And the New Zealand Crime and Victims Survey has confirmed that this is actually a drop in real offending, not just less reporting to police. So we've seen the steady decline since 2017 from 357 per 10,000 resident offences to 212 in March 26. But we're still introducing new laws and inventing new crimes in order to lock up more people.
And to wrap up, are there any key points about this new legislation and its impact on women that you'd want listeners to take away with them?
We need to understand that the impact this is going to have. So we're punishing non-violent offences with very harsh penalties, which then affects innocent children being violated, more likely to be violated, and then suffering as a consequence from trauma that either needs to be healed or that will likely be self-medicated with drugs, which then creates new offences, and we're locking up more of a future generation with that as well. One thing we also need to understand is that the future of this country is lying in the hands of those communities that are currently underserved. So it's in the interest of us all to support those who are in need rather than punish them, because these are our future doctors, our future teachers.
That was Dr. Antia Deckett, Associate Professor in Criminology at Auckland University of Technology, on the impact tougher penalties for theft would have on women and children.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kororo mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Councillor Julie Ferry, Te Ao Māori News' Marnie Dunlop, University of Auckland's Andrew Schelling, and Auckland University of Technology's Dr. Antia Deckett. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Sophia. Ow, ow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.